This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. John Pavlovitz is a pastor from Wake Forest who experienced a number of crises in his life. He lost his father, his job at a megachurch, and after the 2016 election, the progressive pastor lost his sense of hope. John's new book is an effort to get that hope back and spread a message of empowerment. His book is called Hope and Other Superpowers, a life-affirming, love-defending, butt-kicking, world-saving manifesto. John Pavlovitz is on the program now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. So good to be here today.
This book is about framing your own potential, our potential as humans, through your favorite stories, superheroes. Why did you take that as a frame?
Well, I think we love transformation. We love the idea of an ordinary person being thrust into a situation they didn't think they'd find themselves in and then discovering something about themselves in that process. And I think these days that's what we're looking for. We're looking for that moment that we can become something more than we are.
And we've always had that fantasy. You talk about it in your book. Your fantasy is a the superhero you identified with as a kid, right?
Yeah, Peter Parker. I mean, who wouldn't want to be him, yeah. Right? To be able to climb walls and to shoot webs and swing around the city. And for me, I thought of myself as a child that those latent abilities were there somehow. I just had to wait for the moment to tap into them. And so that was a part of my journey.
You also talk about this in the context of religion and your religious odyssey. You were raised as in an Italian family, Roman Catholic, then become the pastor of a megachurch. We'll get to that in a minute, but talk about that upbringing and the impact it had on you.
Yeah, Roman Catholic, Italian, raised on gluten and guilt, you know, those things. And I think that was a huge part of my story, that idea of this there was a right way to live, there was a best way to be human, and that was always something that was instilled in me.
That's the interesting thing about religion and what you tackle, what you've been tackling in your blog and certainly in this book, is that at its heart and in its core, religion is often about the right way to be human in the biggest, broadest sense. And then there are the ways your particular religion says it's right. And that's where sometimes we run afoul of our relationship with the church.
That's right. And I think in the process of writing this book, I started asking people a simple question. What kind of person does the world need? And the answers, there are so much commonality regardless of political affiliation or religious tradition or life stage. And those sort of elemental things that we agree upon, I think those are the places to lean into.
And yet it's precisely because those have become dividing points, fault lines, even among religions, and religions reinforce them. This is an experience you had when you were a mega pastor at a church in Raleigh, right? A mega church in Raleigh.
Yeah, the more I spoke explicitly into matters of sexuality or equality, that's where the pushback came. That's where the turbulence came. And so for me, I had to reach that place where I could either be fully authentic as a pastor and leader, or I could be employed.
Your brother came out as gay before that. What were your feelings at that time?
Well, I think I always knew that there was something wrong with the theology of the church regarding sexuality by and large. And so I was probably more progressive than I was allowed to say I was in the context of where I served. And I just finally realized that I had to kind of be more explicitly open in those things because I owed it to the people that I served and the people who were looking at me as a leader of some sort.
You did. You went to seminary. You ended up getting a job at a megachurch first in Charlotte. So something is propelling you on this journey to become a minister. What were you expecting to do? How were you expecting that to fulfill your aspirations?
Yeah, I was a reluctant pastor. I feel like I was sort of drafted. It was a second career for me, and I just really found working with teenagers as a youth pastor that I had an affinity for that really turbulent time of life, right? So it's sort of like a storm chaser, and that looks horrible. Let's go there. And for me, I just wanted to be a help to people. I saw that that life is difficult, and I wanted to make it less difficult for people. I thought that was what the job of a pastor, a person of faith, should be.
Talk about that church in Raleigh, because I think it's similar to many mega churches and evangelical churches, not all, but many evangelical churches around the country, where there is a strong political component to the religion and the theology, right?
Yeah, I think it's overtly, they're intertwined. We don't often speak about it, but there is a sense of fear that religion leverages and politics often leverages. And when those things are placed together, it's really difficult. And we're often taught that we don't talk about politics, but all ministers do. in what they say or what they don't say. And so I wanted to just finally just to say it.
Well, how are you? I mean, I'm trying to get a sense, too, of the evolution of your perception of all of this. Mm. You're in the church. You're in the seminary. You're hearing this all the time. You're grappling with the big idea. How do I become the best person I was meant to
right.
be? But all these little things are sort of pounding away at you. What were you making of it at the time? You're hearing it the whole time. It comes to a head later. But along the way, what were you thinking?
Well, I think what happens in ministry positions, you become beholden to a community, and it's very seductive. And so you rationalize away many things, or you soften your voice a little bit. So little by little, there either becomes a point where you acquiesce completely or you push back. And the issue of sexuality for me was one where I just could no longer abide it personally. But I think for many people of faith and many pastors, they don't consent to everything happening in the church. Church, but they don't know how to give voice to it, right?
Well, and there are a lot of options at that point. If it does reach ahead in a crisis, mm-hmm. as it did in your case, you know, one is to throw the whole thing away and say, look, this is all a bunch of hypocrisy. It's about identity and mm-hmm. power, and it's never about, you know, some of the things that drew me to this in the first place, and to turn your back on it. But you didn't do that.
No, I think for me, I realized I was released from the church. You know, I heard God calling me to leave in the form of my pastor's voice saying, you're fired. And after that happened, then I realized, okay, I have a gift now. I can ask anything and say everything regarding this faith tradition. And I don't have to hold on to everything. I can let go of some things. And it really made me much freer as a human being and as someone speaking into spirituality.
You then started a blog and it became very popular.
Yeah, it was completely unexpected. Was writing just for sort of an insider church blog, and then it began to reach outside. I wrote a blog post called If I Have Gay Children, and literally within a couple of hours, it reached millions of people, and I'm on CNN the next morning, and there I am kind of getting that much larger table that I had sort of hoped for.
What was that like for you?
That was terrifying,
yeah.
You know, because and you see the way that social media artificially inflates people right. because I'm on TV and it says underneath me, John Pavlovitz, pastor, and it should have said unemployed and currently despondent, right? Life is falling apart. But that showed me that I had no leverage and no political capital. All I had was those simple words from the deepest place in my heart. And those words did a work that only they can do. And I think that's part of the message of my ministry and of this book.
Then you wrote a post immediately after the 2016 election when you were explicit about your misgivings about our current president, and that took off as well.
It did. It was, you know, again, reached quite a few million people. And what that showed me, I didn't become a better writer overnight. It showed me that a lot of people were asking the same questions, feeling the same prompts, and really struggling with the same things that I was struggling with. And there's a beauty in that affinity and the community that's building around that.
You are outspoken about the president and, yeah. and you're critical of the president, but that becomes, doesn't that make you another political pastor?
Yeah, I'm sure it does. For me, Jesus was an entirely political figure, so I never worried about that. I think I want church and state to be separate, but I can't separate my personal politics from my personal faith. It's going to be there.
So how does it, because the pastor at the megachurch can say the same thing, that this is a moral conviction of mine. I truly believe that to be the best person you can be, and then you can outline a number of points on what would be a conservative political agenda that says, this is about morality. It's about how to live your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what my job is to always look at the life and ministry of Jesus, look at his teachings, hold that up to a mirror to my life and my political beliefs and try to see if there are similarities there, if they resemble one another. And if they don't, that's where I'm going to try to push back.
And that works for you. But I mean, again, the criticism, if there is one, and it may not come from you, but it comes from other quarters, that that those ministers are doing exactly the same thing, that Jesus talks about the sanctity, that the ministry of Jesus' life was about the sanctity of human life, and therefore, here's how I feel about abortion.
Yeah, for sure. There, that tension's always going to be there when you're a person of faith trying to speak into the world that is outside of the church. And so you're always going to have to try to see if you're consistent, and if you are, if what you say and do and teach really makes people's lives more compassionate and more loving.
Let's see how this worked in your life. And again, getting back to your book, how superheroes plays a part, your own experience with the passing of your dad
yeah.
Ended up teaching you more about the power of grief and empathy.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, I'm sitting in a coffee shop right after my father passed, and my friend Brenda said, you know, John, I know you're grieving, I know you're suffering, but there's something else here for you. There's an invitation. She said, you're going to tap into an empathy that you didn't know you had. And when you see people who are grieving, you're going to speak their language very specifically, and it's going to help people. Of course, at the time, I didn't want to hear it, right? Yeah. I just thought, well, this, I'm going through my own personal hell. But she was right, because that is how this, that's how pain and suffering and adversity work. They birth something in us that we could have no other way.
But that, it's fascinating that you do this, because you're talking about pain and suffering and grief, and these are things that certainly Americans do not associate with power. In fact, it's precisely powerlessness that you've just described in three different categories. And yet you have found that there is a superpower in this. Can you help me through that?
Well, I think when you are in those low places, it's your responsibility to remember how it felt to be in those places. And so as any sort of leader, I think always needs to be looking at the people underneath them, or just the people around you as a human being, and saying, who is invisible? Who is struggling? And to try to alleviate that, to lift burdens off already burdened people, because everyone around you is going through something like that.
Where is the power in that?
I think the power is in what you know, the book is not a self-help book. It's really about living outwardly. When you live outwardly, that's really the best version of yourself. So the power is not in anything you accumulate. It's about what you give to other people.
And so we talk about finding your own superpowers. You were stuck with a kind of fearlessness, I think, that Tony Stark displays in the Avengers film. So let's now listen to Tony Stark facing off against his opponent, Loki.
When they come, and they will, they'll come for you.
I have an army.
We have a Hulk.
Oh, I thought the Beast had won it off.
You're missing the point. There's no throne. There is no version of this where you come out on top.
There it is. Iron Man Tony Stark facing off against Loki, the adopted brother of Thor, you remember, in the Avengers movie. What does this say for you? I mean, again, take us back to and think about the trope. And now in popular culture, we're very aware of superheroes. Mm-hmm. How do we identify with this, and how can we use this as a way to do? I mean, you say it's not a self-help book, but it is a way that can help instruct us on the journey.
Yeah, I think it's looking at, you know, superhero mythology is wonderful. Sometimes people are endowed with gifts already, and they have this sort of pivot point moment, but sometimes it's a gradual thing. I love superheroes like Rogue from the X-Men. Her superpower is that she places her hand on someone and she can immediately feel all their feelings and think all their thoughts and see all their journey. And I think there's something about that. Or you look at someone like Ant-Man, who becomes microscopic and he can reach places that other superheroes can't. And that idea of smallness and humility. I think when we lean into those things, we can see something that's very counter to what we're seeing in America right now. That idea of humility, that idea of compassion.
There's a wonderful moment in the gospel where Jesus is surrounded by a crowd and a woman touches him, though he's not aware of it. And the phrase is, the power went out of him. Mm-hmm. And he said, who touched me? And of course, his disciples are saying, we're in a crowd. There's thousands of people. What do you mean, who touched you? Everybody touched you. Yeah. They can't imagine what he's talking about. But he knew that someone in great pain, as it will turn out later in that story, touched him. And the power didn't generate, it actually went out of him.
Right.
Which is something I think the prosperity gospel misses entirely.
Yeah, a little bit. And I think, you know, in the story of Rogue, for example, she gets that story of another person in an instant. And I think we have to be story learners. We have to be with people that we think we're prone to caricaturize or make cartoons out of. We need to actually learn those stories. I think that's what's going to help us right now.
Now, you talked about being in this very hopeless place in the immediate aftermath of the 2016 election, and that in some ways writing this book was a way to get you out of that funk, huh?
Yeah, I'm an Olympic level pessimist at times. I think if you care about people and you see people in duress, that's always going to cause you to grieve that, and right, and sometimes it's going to look like anger. And I think it's really important right now that we cultivate hope, we cultivate positivity, as it is a discipline to get up every day and to either choose despair or hope, or to, you know, and I think that's important.
All right, but now you really have to help me through this, because if you watch what's going on at the national scene, it is despicable, and what is happening to other human beings and how they're being spoken about from the highest office in this land is something that is a travesty and an abomination in the sight of God. How do you take that? How do you It seems to me it's a way of seeing. It's a way of not seeing that, because you don't want to do a Pollyanna where you say, well, but in the next life, everything will be okay. It almost sounds like you have to activate a different human and put that vision aside, not dismiss it, not diminish it, but see another vision instead. Is that, am I on the track here? Or not?
Yeah, I think if you're not disgusted and disheartened by what's happening, then you're not really fully alive. And I think what happens is you need to transform that into something. And so what I do is get up every day and say, I'm pushing back against something, but I'm also looking at who is being damaged by that something I'm pushing back against and giving that time and energy. So some days I'm fighting legislation and fighting politicians, and some days I'm spending time with people who are being disenfranchised or marginalized.
Because it does seem like one of the things that the trap for a superhero is to become so narcissistically involved with their power to transform, or their mission to transform, that it becomes yet another ego trip, which gets you almost back to the same place.
Yeah. I think it's time. You need to spend time away from the fray and be just simply in relationship with people, because, you know, I travel the country all the time now. And when I get time in a community with people, I see those beautiful things that are happening in response to what's happening in our country. And that's a story that doesn't always trend. That's a news feed you don't always see. And I think the more we focus on that, the more we can kind of keep going into the day.
John Pavlovitz, pastor from Wake Forest, his new book, Hope and Other Superpowers, a life-affirming, life-defending, butt-kicking, world-saving manifesto. John, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find a link to his book at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.